The following program is a presentation of Grace Communion International and Grace Communion Seminary and is made possible by generous donations from viewers like you. In this episode of You're Included, Dr. Carrie Magruder discusses the intersection of faith and science. Our host is Dr. Gary Detto.
Carrie, thanks for being with us here for this segment of You're Included.
It's a delight.
So I know a little bit about your past and your current responsibilities here as curator of the history of science at collections at the University of Oklahoma. And also you do some teaching as well there, so you're on the faculty.
That's right.
That's a pretty interesting combination. How did you pick up that job? How did that happen?
It was a bolt from the blue, not something I deserved, but I went through the graduate program in history of science at the University of Oklahoma, so it's quite unusual to be hired by the institution one graduates from, but the curator at the time, Marilyn Ogilvie, the second curator, asked me if I would be interested in being her assistant, and that just seemed like an unexpected dream come true. And it was a joy to work with her under her mentorship for about 9 years until she retired in 2009. And for some reason, they went ahead and gave me the curator position after that.
Fantastic. Now, that signals you must have had an interest in science somewhere early on in your life.
Oh my, yes. So my father taught chemistry at Truman State University and also science education, my mother education. And so I grew up in an environment surrounded by science, hanging out in the science division, and getting to know all the professors and visiting all the labs, and being surrounded at home with educators in their spare time. They would just be dropping by the house. And so it was an exciting environment to grow up in a climate that emphasized both the beauty and creativity of science within the context of the human side that you get with the focus on education. And I treasure that heritage very much.
So science, not just kind of in the lab, but in an educational setting, the two elements working together.
That's right. The educational side shows the creativity and resourcefulness that is far more part of the scientific method than the way it's usually presented in the textbooks. And I remember being carted off to science ed conferences and seeing that kind of perspective on science, being around people who wanted to impart that to students in their classrooms at all levels, elementary and middle school, not just the high school. So I am certain that that played a role in my eventual turn to the history of science.
Okay. Now at some point along the way, you gain an interest in seeing the connection between science and faith. And of course, that's been a long debate and all that. I don't know what your home was caught up in that, or your church, or whatever. But somehow that came together for you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
My parents are of very devout faith, but we've always been churchgoers. But we valued the family as the locus of our faith, and probably because of that environment of being around scientists and science educators, I was never in a church environment where the crisis was felt acutely. And so I had leisure. For some reason, a seventh grade English teacher, just before we were learning how to diagram sentences, gave me a copy of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis with permission to read it, I guess so I wouldn't be a bother in class. And from Lewis, I got this perspective of all of culture being connected to faith. And not too long after that, a college friend pointed me to the writings of Francis Schaeffer and the concept of Jesus as Lord of all of life, including nature and history and culture, seemed natural to me. So by the time I entered high school, I used to go over to the university library and I would watch over and over again the video series, The Ascent of Man by Jacob Bronowski, and became thoroughly familiar with the book. And I was enchanted by the perspective on science that the history, a cultural history of science, could offer. And it was also clear to me that that would be a place where a more rigorous exploration of the issues of science and faith might take place.
So interesting. So we've got science, we've got education, we've got faith, and now we've added in the history of science, because not all scientists really take quite such an interest in the history of science. They're more focused on just their own discipline, but somehow you saw this, the historical element being important as well.
That's right. So I think that was common to the scientific culture that I grew up in, as represented by the educators and by Jacob Bronowski's humanist perspective on science. And I mean humanist not in a disparaging way, but in a very human affirming way, that when one steps back and takes a look at science over the course of history, one immediately sees how creative it is, how human it is, how determined and resourceful individual scientists have been and communities are as well. Something that you don't sense from the textbooks that make it look like a story of inevitable progress.
Yes, that's what I was thinking as you were talking, that often you get the picture of a scientist in a laboratory working with things, and often by themselves. I mean, they may have an assistant or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think what I'm getting here is the human element is often screened out, mm-hmm. and yet it's very much an actual part of the practice. And of course, there is a history.
Oh, exactly.
There is a history. So that, yeah, that's a much bigger picture.
So I loved hanging out in the labs. My father let me assist in chemistry labs, for example, while I was still in high school. And I think my first love is biochemistry. I was set on pursuing a doctorate in biochemistry before I made a professional turn to history of science. But there was a historian of science at Truman, what's now Truman State University, and he let me sit in on his classes the summer between my junior and senior years. And I loved it. But I still didn't realize that was a field one could enter until many years later. I was back in my hometown, ran into him at a Dairy Queen, and he said, "Why don't you check out the University of Oklahoma? They have a great collection of books. I think you would really enjoy that combination of academic inquiry and the original books." And he was not an alumnus of Oklahoma, but he sent me that way. And that's when I made the decision to change to history of science.
Oh, that's an interesting story. Yeah, people involved there and step-by-step guiding. Now, at some point, you ran into the writings of Thomas F. Torrance. And as a kind of, you know, well-known theologian, but he also had an interest in science as well, especially Einstein, James Clerk Maxwell, and others. But somehow how did you cross paths with Thomas Torrance and his writings?
So it really was very late in my development as a historian of science. While even as early as those high school years, I was aware of the work of Michael Polanyi and others that were in the ambit of Thomas Torrance, I had not heard of his name until I went to a history of science or science and religion conference held in Ontario in the early 90s. At that stage, I had invested nearly a year working on a dissertation topic. So I'd finished my preliminary curriculum in the history of science, and I was focused on chance in Occam's physics, which I thought was a remarkably interesting topic. And after a lecture that he gave, I was so blown away by what he said. I went down to talk to him, and I asked him a simple question, and he leaned back in the communion of saints, and he was in the company of Duns Scotus, and he recited in Latin a paragraph of Scotus critiquing Occam. And a moment later, his eyes were piercingly upon me, and he showed me that I needed to go back and rethink my fundamental categories, that everything I had learned from Aristotle and the Scholastics was on shakier ground that could be reframed in a way that matched the vision of science as a human endeavor involving commitment that I imbibed from Polanyi. So I knew I had to rethink everything, and I just said, I'm going to go read your books. So a year later, I switched my dissertation topic as a result of beginning to process Torrance's critique in less than 5 minutes. But it took time to process it, and I turned to the development of the historical sciences, such as geology, because of what Torrance, through Duns Scotus, challenged me in thinking through the consequences of divine freedom for contingent order.
Yeah, that was a big shift in many ways. I mean, many, of course, PhD students, it's a frightening thing to set your thesis and to follow through, but to work it through, yeah, and to change directions, not only just on a topic, but kind of the whole approach. That's yes. That's a big, well, paradigm shift, huh?
Oh, it certainly was, yes.
Well, that's a great story. Now, I first actually ran into you, indirectly, of course, because I, being interested in Thomas Torrance and all, having studied with James Torrance, his younger brother, and all, I ran into Carrie's loft. Well, I had no idea who Carrie was and all, and here we are years later. But anyway, I was fascinated because I said, wow, I mean, this website, I don't know who this is. And I've never seen him at an academic conference that I've been to, but this is one of the most amazing lists of sources of Torrance that I've ever run across. And there are other shorter lists here and there, and I had my own shorter list, actually. How did that come about, the Carrie's Loft?
Ever since that initial encounter with Torrance, because I came to Torrance and Trinitarian theology through academic inquiry in the history of science, not through theology. But after that initial encounter, when he had challenged me to completely reframe my approach to the history of science, I knew that when the time would come, as soon as it would be appropriate, he would do the same thing for my theological outlook. So after I had a job and had published several articles and was at a more stable point in life, I just felt it was time. Now is the time to read Torrance systematically, his theology as well as the writings on science. And I knew that was going to be an endeavor that would be, I thought, a five-year endeavor. That's much longer than that, a lifelong endeavor, certainly. So I started the blog in order to be a personal, not a professional, outlet for my processing of Torrance. Mm. And that's what it quickly became, because at that point, shortly after that, I discovered the You're Included series. And that provided me with the sense, I'm not alone on this quest. There are all these amazing scholars, pastors, theologians, those in other disciplines, represented in the You're Included series, who could be a reading list to help me in that journey to begin to assimilate Torrance in a more holistic way.
All right, well, interesting.
So it's an attic. Carrie's Loft, it's an attic. It's not a professional job. Mm-hmm. History of science is not a major theme there, although there are some talks that I've given on Copernicus or Babylonian astronomy or the nature of a university, etc. But it's meant to be a personal scrapbook.
Yes, right. Well, it's been helpful to others. Well, I know there's others as well.
I'm so glad to hear that.
That have referred to that, and it was a delight to meet you later in person. So, now, along the way also, I think another interesting element of your journey is the interdisciplinary aspect of it. Because often, again, you kind of think, well, you can think of theology, or you can think of science, or you can think of biology or physics, you know, very discrete, you know, focus for study and all, and not very disciplined. Of course, and there's the legendary split in the university between the humanities and social sciences and the sometimes called the hard sciences, right? And this and that. But somehow, what caught your attention is the interdisciplinary nature of it. Can you tell us some about how that kind of wrapped in there?
So this is one of the central themes, I think, that intrigues practically everyone drawn to the study of science over its history, is how disciplines are not set in stone, but they're a braided stream and there are reconfigurations. So the study of the disciplinary interrelations is front and center in the history of science. I view it as an outgrowth of the liberal arts tradition, where we are our study of any particular subject on its own terms is nevertheless informed by its relationships with other disciplines. Or maybe to put it this way, I've always thought of science for me as a way of entering into an objective world. The study of nature draws me out from myself. Mm. And so it becomes an act of love to try to understand a field of science. And as the love grows, there's a passion to understand multiple fields, and they neither historically nor by nature exist in isolation. So out of love, we as we try to live in a full circle of reality, then we're committed to that interdisciplinary liberal arts vision. To me, it's the one of the chief challenges faced by a modern research university like the University of Oklahoma is that every interesting problem on an emerging research frontier is a multidisciplinary problem. Mm. It's not puzzle solving within the areas of specialization, but the really challenging work occurs where many people from different disciplines work together to forge new methods, new kinds of questions. They have to adjust their expectations on the types of evidence that they will prioritize. Mm. And so science in real time is an interdisciplinary endeavor on its own. Perhaps the educators see that more clearly, mm-hmm. and it's what we historians love to study.
I would think so, yes. Well, I also know you have an interest in Galileo, and actually my own background years ago in terms of dipping into the history of science at all had a lot to do with Galileo. I was into, as a kid, telescopes and things. Yes. Of course, if you go that direction, you got to run into them sooner or later, right?
Absolutely.
And all that. Not that you get the whole story. That's part of the problem, I think, right. Here. But tell us about your interest in Galileo. I know some of your curating work has had to do with that as well. How would Galileo fit into all this?
Oh, sure. So in graduate school, and I might mention that we, back in those days, the Oklahoma graduate program required 4 years of general study before beginning specialized dissertation work. And a hot topic of research at that time was the connection between Galileo and his medieval scholastic forebears. So in the 1200s, but especially in the early 1300s, theologians were using mathematics in order to chart how a person grows in grace over time through the means of grace, like participating in the sacraments. And they came up with a formula and a way to chart it that is formally identical to Galileo's law of free fall. Much of this thinking in terms of logical, causal categories still persists in theological traditions. It was characteristic of this medieval 14th century tradition, but it soon became generalized not just to growth in grace, but change of inequality and eventually change in location or motion as well. Hmm. And that happened before Galileo. Galileo was aware of these discussions. He did not discover the law of free fall through the experiments using the inclined plane. He already knew it from this theological tradition. He verified it experimentally with the inclined plane, but he didn't come up with it. Hmm. So this connection exploring this was a central area of discussion in the discipline back in the 80s and 90s during my graduate study. But then when I had the privilege of returning to OU as curator, OU happens to hold an amazing Galileo collection. Galileo wrote, depending on how you count them, about 12 books. It's quite rare for a major library to hold more than two or three, or six might be exceptional. OU holds all 12. Wow. Four of the OU copies contain Galileo's handwriting. And then there are the books in multiple editions, the books by his friends and collaborators. So it's a remarkable Galileo collection. So being the custodian of that collection, I very quickly started to receive invitations to talk about the life and works of Galileo at Fermilab in Chicago, or NASA headquarters in Virginia, and universities across the country. To me, the more one is aware of all of his works, the more one can see Galileo becomes more human and less of a caricature. He's not a point in some argument. He becomes someone of interest in his own right. That's what I've tried to do in my work on Galileo.
Well, let me ask one more question here about that. Because, of course, in popular circles, Galileo, it's always the church versus Galileo, Galileo versus the church, and that's really all you hear. I think there's more to that story. Aspect of that? I know you can't tell us the whole story, but is there some aspect of that you think, kind of like the missing piece? Would be helpful to hear, for us to hear?
In a nutshell, what I often explain to the public or students or campus guests who wish to see certain items from the Galileo collection, a point I try to make is that many of Galileo's strongest supporters were in the church, especially the Jesuits early on, because the Jesuits were trained in mathematics. And so they recognized what Galileo was doing, and they were very sympathetic. While on the other hand, many of Galileo's strongest opponents were the physicists in the universities, who were paid three times as much as the mathematicians. The physicists were not trained in mathematics. They used qualitative principles and Aristotelian logic to tell you the truth. Mathematicians only did calculations. And so Galileo was part of the generation saying, we mathematicians can do physics better than the physicists. But it was a turf war. And so just that is enough to substitute a perspective of complexity for an oversimplified conflict thesis. I love the way that the director of the Vatican Observatory, and yes, the Vatican has an observatory and it's been active for hundreds of years, Brother Guy Consolmagno, a Jesuit, a noted meteorite specialist, he begins many of his talks on this topic with just a brilliant sentence. It summarizes everything exactly. He says, everything you think you know about Galileo is wrong, but the truth won't make the church look any better. So it's complicated.
Yes.
That's the message I try to get across.
I bet it would be. Well, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
You've been watching You're Included, a production of Grace Communion International.